As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
What's up and welcome back to Spin Rate the Athletic's Toronto Blue Jays podcast. My name is Drew Fairservice. I'm back here with Caitlin McGrath, who more than ably stepped in to the hosting role last week while I was ever so briefly off. The Jon Stewart v. Larry Sanders vibes continue. Caitlin, how are you?
I'm good. Back in Toronto. Which is nice because I've been away for like a week.
How was Minnesota? That's a nice ballpark they got there.
It is a nice ballpark in Minneapolis. It's good location as well.
Mm-hmm.
This time around, the last time I was in Minneapolis, it was September. And I was staying in a different spot. Still downtown, but just like off the side a little more. This time I was more central and... In Minneapolis, they have this thing. It's called the Skywalk. I think they call it the Skywalk. And so it's basically all the buildings downtown, office buildings, hotels, everything, mm-hmm. is connected on the second floor. So the second floor of it, basically every building is somewhat like food courts and shops and stuff. And then they're all connected by these skywalks. It's very similar to what Toronto has in terms of the underground, mm-hmm. Or the path. But... it's just in the sky. And so on the Friday game, I believe, I did the walk to the ballpark, but only using the Skywalk. So my hotel connected basically all the way to Target Field. So you're doing that whole entire walk indoors and then you step out and you're right there. So it's cool. It was nice because it was hot. I think presumably the function of it is more for the winters when it's cold and people don't want to walk outside. But in the summertime, it's convenient as well. But it does close on the weekend, which was not super convenient for me because then I didn't realize that and I tried to do it and I was locked out. So lesson learned.
I do get that. The path has its charms, I guess. Mm-hmm. There was the salad place that I used to go to all the time and that was in the path. That's like my lasting memory of the value of the path was going there to get a nice salad. But we're back.
The salad place that was... by the Dollarama there?
Yeah, like right at Bloor and like Church, sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it called? Salad King or Salad?
Salad King, I think. I think it was Salad. Because a lot of people that worked at Post Media went there when we were... I assume that's when you went there?
It was... And I worked nearby as well. I worked when when I left Post Media and I went to an agency that was one block further west from when you and I worked together at Post Media. We worked together here on this show called Spinrate that we do twice a week. We, of course, being me, my name is Drew Fairservice. I am one of the co-hosts of Spinrate. Caitlin McGrath is one of the other co-hosts of Spinrate. She covers the Blue Jays for The Athletic. You can read everything that she writes about the Blue Jays. The surging Blue Jays, splitting a four-game series in the Minnesota Blue Jays, leading the wild card in the American League Blue Jays. She covers them for The Athletic. So if you go to theathletic.com/spinrate, subscribe, bang, you get it all. You get everything that Caitlin writes, plus everything everybody else writes about the Blue Jays, about trades and transactions and prospects and everything, all sports. including the footy, which started this weekend in England, starts next week, this coming weekend in Italy. The Athletic's football coverage is second to none. So hook that up if you are into the beautiful game. We do the show twice a week, as I said. Last week, Caitlin and Josh broke down the trade deadline, and then me and the other co-host of the Josh Goldberg, who stepped in more than ably. And then me and the other co-host, it's Ricky Romero, former Blue Jays All-Star, Cy Young vote receiver. He and I do the show later in the week. So that's what you get when you subscribe to the Spin Rate, which you should do everywhere you get your podcasts. But we're going to start by talking about something, a player that came over at the trade deadline and has made a semi-immediate impact with a bit of a heads-up play on what was a very controversial controversy in Sunday's fourth game of the series in Minnesota, which is probably as good a place to any as to start. We can start talking about that. We'll talk about some injuries in the state of the Blue Jays right now, as well as take a quick look at the offense and looking ahead to the Orioles coming to town. Right? Yes, coming to town. There's Caitlin in Toronto, so they're coming to town.
No, they're in Baltimore. I just did not go.
They're in Baltimore. Caitlin's here. Fair enough. I know they're playing Baltimore. That's well, the extent of my knowledge. Let's start talking about the Whit Merrifield play that ended the game. Rocco Baldelli, former member of the Tampa Bay Rays, former member of the Boston Red Sox, current manager of the Minnesota Twins, blew his stack after the review revealed that Twins catcher, I believe it was Gary Sanchez behind the plate,
he was. Yep.
Had in fact blocked Whit Merrifield's progress on his way in on a tag play to left field where former Tampa Bay Ray, former top overall, I believe, draft pick Tim Beckham was playing left field, played first base earlier in the series. There he is in left field, made a really strong throw on a ball that was not hit particularly deep, but strong base running from Whit Merrifield, as well as a really heads-up play. I don't know, Caitlin, if you want to talk about or remind those who may not have seen Whit's quote about what he had mentioned. You don't have to obviously quote him verbatim, but he had a plan going in on this sack fly play based on something he had seen previously. I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but do you remember what he had said and what kind of how it all transpired here in the bottom top of the 10th inning on Sunday?
Yeah, well, essentially he noticed a few nights ago that the way that Gary Sanchez set up at the plate when there could be a play at the plate was that he was standing essentially in the lane that would be the runner's lane. And so he observed that and kind of probably knew Gary Sanchez too, just because players scout each other and they probably mm-hmm. know, especially a player like Whit, who base running would be such a essential part of his game. You would think that he would really know catchers and particularly how they set up at the plate because he's probably involved in a lot of those plays. So he knew how he was going to stand there. And sure enough, when he was making that play at third, Gary Sanchez was setting up the same way. And essentially, he just tried to slide in basically as best he could, kind of in a way and such that, and kind of John Schneider alluded to this, the slide was such that it kind of revealed that he was blocking the plate, essentially. It was the type of play where I don't even know if his legs even got in. I mean, they did eventually touch home plate, but I don't think the controversy or the immediately when John Schneider went out, I think the umpire asked him, like, what are you challenging, that he touched the plate or blocking the plate? And John Schneider was like, blocking the plate, like that. And that was the only way the Blue Jays were going to get that call, right? If they had mm-hmm. challenged, no, he's safe, it wouldn't have shown that. So Blue Jays heads up play from them, John Schneider, their video and like their video guys that sit in the back room and are looking at that, realizing they can challenge it. Obviously, Whit Merrifield heads up play as well. So yeah, it was essentially sliding in such a way that the blocking the plate call is easier to call, right? Is that what you're alluding to?
Yeah. I think that he anticipated that where Gary Sanchez, who's never been regarded often, sometimes unfairly, as a strong defensive catcher, that this might be something he could take advantage of in the event that he was thrown out. I don't think he went in there being like, I'm going to get an interference call on this. He went in there thinking, I'm going to score, but all else being equal, I'm going to do, I think, which is a part of that heads up play, which was sliding feet first. mm-hmm. not trying to slide head first and like dive around the slide or anything, going in feet first, being like, there's not going to be an angle. If there's not an angle and I don't beat the throw and the throw is good, then I'm going to make sure that, you know, kind of put the onus on Sanchez to do the piece of his job that is required by that play. And then also kind of putting a bit of an onus on the replay umpire, which in the end worked out for the Blue Jays, much to the chagrin of these quickly ejected and then post-game incandescent Rocco Baldelli. He was ranting. Yeah.
And it's funny because, well, not funny, but like the Twins writers being there, they came up a little bit after us, before us, I don't remember. But anyway, the whole gist is that Rocco Baldelli is very mild-mannered, calm. Mm-hmm. I don't think he gets heated much. And the thing that I've heard from the writers and such about Baldelli is that he always finds a polite way to say things, or, you know, can always find some positive in a situation. So the contrast of who he is usually to who he was after Sunday's game, I wonder if, and we'll get into this, I guess, but I wonder if the way that he acted, he may have had suspected he was going to get fined or potentially even suspended anyway. So he might've just had at it after the game. And I say that I read Aaron Gleeman's story where he sort of alluded to potentially there's a suspension or fine coming. I think he's just speculating. I don't think he knows that, but mm-hmm. That's
well,
how I'm
you're not supposed
that.
To, you're not supposed to argue after the replay, right? Like that's essentially an automatic ejection. The replay right. thing, like, it's been called, it's been reviewed, it's a final decision, is final. So you're wasting your breath. So, you know, I think that there's no harm in getting your money's worth if you already know that what you've done is gonna affect the pocketbook, I suppose. I don't know. Let me ask you then this, Caitlin. What do you think of the rule as it was called? Do you think that is, Baldelli was talking about, it's not fair to both teams that are out there playing so hard and then have this sort of, I believe he used something to the effect of like chicken shit call. That's not a non-competitive play or something like that. Like, do you think that's the right call? Do you think it's the, you know, it was called accurately?
Well, it's funny because Baldelli also in his rant, he went on about how this call is never made and it's been in existence for however many years, and there's been thousands and thousands of instances of this and they hardly ever make this call. Funnily enough, and I'm sure he wasn't aware of this because he was managing his own game, but at the same time, or just hours, like minutes, hours, I don't know how much before it actually was, but there was a play in the Orioles and Pirates game that was very similar. It was also overturned. Like, I think it was the Orioles catcher was ruled blocking the plate, I believe. I think that's how it went down, but it was in that play. And so it was funny that he was going on this rant about how it was like never, ever been called, and it's been called twice in the same day within a matter of probably hours of each other. You know what? I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on this rule in terms of this is probably the first time that I've covered a game where it's been called or it's been impactful. I'm not sure that I've ever called a game. I'm not sure that I've ever covered a game that had this kind of play. Certainly not that I remember this being as controversial as this one was. So I, reading the comments and reading just the talk around it, the discourse around this play, I can see how it went the Blue Jays' way in this instance. And you kind of alluded to it, like Gary Sanchez does not have the reputation as a great defensive catcher, the way that he's positioning. And I think the rule is that you can't be in their way, you can't be in the runner's way until you have the ball in possession. And so you kind of see where Sanchez is standing before he has the ball, that it's kind of standing in the lane in which Witt is going. At the same time, as we just discussed, like, Witt was really heads up about it and mm-hmm. played it such that, like you said, this call, or like we both said, like, this call would be easier for the review officials to make because of the way that Witt played it. So I think the Blue Jays were pretty lucky to get this overturned, honestly, because this is probably one of those gray area type rules. And it sometimes come down to who's sitting in that review booth in New York on days, and how they're viewing it and how they interpret the rule. So I kind of understand how both sides came at it. And actually the Blue Jays, they were honestly surprised they got the call. I think Witt was the one who was not, at least didn't say he was surprised. He was more like, I'm glad they got it right. I wish they got it right in the moment, because it was all along. That's what I saw. John Schneider was a little bit more, I'm a little bit surprised they called it, but I agree that it's the right call. Of course, they're going to say that. And even Kevin Gausman, actually, after the game, which I didn't include in my story because long rant, of course, the games that are long and complicated is the one time that I'm like, oh, I'm going to fly home the same night. I'll make my flight. It's fine. Anyway, so I was in a bit of a scramble, my own little scramble, trying to get to the airport. And so anyway, but Kevin Gausman basically had the perspective of that he's seen enough baseball games where your team is involved in somewhat of a controversial play and it doesn't go your way. And so I think he said that he didn't want to get his hopes up, so he sort of thought that it wasn't going to get overturned, and then he was glad that it did, because he's like, oh, I like to be surprised. I like to not think it's going to work out, and then when it does work out, I'm happy about it. So he was just kind of, I think that's just his perspective. But yeah, different sides obviously are going to disagree about this one, and the Blue Jays were probably, I mean, on the one hand, they were leading that whole game and it was tight, and then they just let it go in the ninth. And so they were pretty lucky to get away with that win. At the same time, we should mention that when the Blue Jays scored, it wasn't a walk-off. It's not as though the game ended. The Twins had a runner on second and three chances to get him home, and they didn't. They didn't score a run in the bottom half of that inning, and Jordan Romano was coming back out. They had already got to him a little bit, so the situation was certainly not building towards an inevitable Blue Jays win. You had Romano, who had just had a rocky ninth inning. You had all this controversy swirling. It was a very tense game. It had been a tense series. The crowd was really going. It was really loud, and the Twins obviously weren't able to score. The Blue Jays walk away with a series split. They were really happy with that. But yeah, crazy game.
We'll be right back with more Spin Rate. But first, check this out.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
At the risk of delving into a cliche, the momentum was not with the Blue Jays in that moment. They had, as you said, sort of kind of given up a run and then blown save in the top of the bottom of the ninth. But I think I would agree that it was called correctly. I think that the rule's been around for 8-9 years. 2014 was the first year of the rule. 2013 was when Buster Posey got hurt. Giants fans will protest loudly. It is not the Buster Posey rule. There was somebody else got hurt that actually was a greater impetus to the rule coming in. It just has been credited, for lack of a better term, to Buster Posey. But the rule's been around for a long time. I think it's important to keep the players on the field to protect them from injury, to take that. It can still be a physical game, but that doesn't mean that there need to be attempts to dislodge the ball or run guys over. I think if Sanchez just drops his left leg back and is a bit more even, just a little bit more square to the bag and where the throw is coming from, he can make that same play. The ball beat him by enough that if he's kind of offering the plate to him as he's letting the ball come in, he can make, he can receive the ball, get down and put the tag down and get that part of the plate there. I agree that Merrifield knew, like had anticipated it, made a heads up play, made the call easy for them to get right. And the one thing if you watch the replay, he's calling for it right away. He slides in feet first and then starts pointing. He's pointing right at Sanchez's legs.
Yeah, I actually asked him after the game because I noticed that too. And I was wondering what he was saying. Was he saying, I'm in, or like, what is he saying? And he said, he's blocking the plate. He was blocking the plate. Like he said it right away. And basically the home plate umpire told him, yeah, like they're going to look at it. John Schneider had come out, like they're going to look at it. So right away he knew. And to your other point, Whit Merrifield even said after the game, if this rule wasn't in place, then he could have just gone and collided with Sanchez to try and free the ball up so that he's called safe, right? Like that's, as you say, that's why the rule was put in place. And so that's to make the game safer. And obviously sometimes with you have these types of rules where there is some gray area and some needed interpretation of the rules, then you're going to have some teams that disagree with it. Usually the team that is on the losing side of it. But yeah, I think that this was an instance where you could really see Sanchez was kind of in the lane the entire time, well before the ball was in his glove. And as you say, I think there was enough time to make the play had he just done it the correct way.
The correct, maybe not how he was coached and taught as a young player, but the way that the game is played now. So we can move on from this. Obviously, it's a good way for the Blue Jays to, they don't ask how many, and it was a win. They split the series with the Twins. What do you think about what we've seen from Whit Merrifield? Is this maybe an example of the kind of heads up and like base running is kind of a bit of his calling card, stealing bases and things like that. Mm-hmm. This is a hopeful sign of what he can offer. The Blue Jays are and always have been a very aggressive base running team, but I don't know that outside of Kevin Biggio, they don't have a great base runner in particular. Yeah. Bo's pretty good. Bo's aggressive, and Teoscar Hernandez is fast and good at taking the extra base. You're right. Bo is good, and Vlad has become Vlad has always been a very aggressive base runner, and I think he still is. But that stolen base and that high efficiency in his steals as well is something that they can get from Merrifield, who is a regular as opposed to Kevin Biggio, who's more of like a part time player at this point.
Yes, well, and Merrifield will be a regular a lot more now with George Springer on the IL because Whit Merrifield seems to be their, I wouldn't say their preferred center fielder option, but he's certainly one and Raimel Tapia is the other. But in terms of the trade for Merrifield, yes, when it happened, you're initially a bit confused, honestly, because it came out of nowhere a little bit and it really came in right at the wire. So you're kind of like pitching had been the priority and all of a sudden it's like Jeff Passan was like, and the Blue Jays traded for Whit Merrifield. And you're like, what? Also because we knew him to be unvaccinated only a few weeks ago. So that was a confusing part as well. Obviously, he is now vaccinated and will, as he's put it, will be in Toronto when the team is in Toronto. But in terms of what he's brought, now that that's sort of in the rear mirror, thankfully, because you just want that to be settled. But when you're seeing Whit Merrifield play and what I've observed, I'm almost like, did they get this guy just to like give John Schneider like a toy to play with in terms of just like the way that he likes to manage the team and the strengths that Whit Merrifield has completely line up with how we've seen the Blue Jays try to play lately, especially when John Schneider took over. And you just see the smile on John Schneider's face when he's discussing Whit Merrifield in the speed and just saying he's got the green light to go whenever he wants kind of thing. And his speed is, as we saw on Sunday, game changing for the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays don't win that game, I don't think. Well, who knows what would have happened, but in an alternate universe, maybe if they don't have Whit Merrifield, but they won because of his speed. And I think we're not to dwell on that play too much, but let's just mention this part as well. Actually, the play getting to third was almost as tight, if not tighter. And that was a tough play because you're dealing with not an infielder in the outfield throwing to home. You're dealing with Buxton, who has a great arm from center. And granted, he was just coming into the game. He hadn't played the whole game. But that was really close play at third. If he hadn't done that, then they don't even have a play at the plate. So yeah, his speed has been great. His center field play has been pretty good so far. Obviously, it's only been like three games or so. The funny thing too was there was a game, I think it was Friday, might have been Saturday, but there was a game when it was Merrifield was in center, and then they made some pinch hitting substitutions, and it's like Merrifield's in second, and then like the next inning's like, okay, now Merrifield's back in center, and it's like he's just a guy that you can just move around. And even John Schneider said like the next day, yeah, he brings all his gloves to the dugout, so you can just move him around in game and he's fine with that. And so it's the Blue Jays had that a little bit with some other guys, but Whit Merrifield definitely seems to be it's almost his specialty at this point. I think he really enjoys it. And having another option for center field is really huge. I almost think that even though the Blue Jays didn't say this, you have to kind of presume that the uncertainty around George Springer's elbow had to be a factor in why they went out and got Whit Merrifield. I mean, I don't, even though they're not going to say it because they don't want to see, you know, say anything about George's elbow or whatever, but it had to be a factor. And you see why. Like he's been great in that role so far.
We've seen the best of what the Blue Jays ever would have expected to get when they were acquiring Whit Merrifield, not Mitt Merrifield. He does not play. He plays for the bizarro Jays that play on the West Coast. What we saw on Friday night that you just alluded to is exactly, that's something that Ricky and I talked about on our last episode, which is what I thought you might see with Merrifield, which is he'll be in center field and then they move him into second when they want to do their full outfield defense kind of arrangement, yeah, bring Zimmer in. Then that way, you know, as I kind of suggested, or what I think is probably going to happen is you're going to see a little bit less of Espinal and Biggio in particular, second base, when he's able to make that move. But then circumstance had them move him back because the Blue Jays, under no circumstances want to give Bradley Zimmer even a single at bat. They like don't, well, they'll do anything to keep him out of the batter's box. So they did exactly that, where they move Merrifield from center to second, Zimmer goes into center, and then they need to pinch hit for Zimmer. So Biggio hits for him, and then they make that switch back again. So that's something that I'm going to kind of keep my eye on. I think that makes a lot of sense, the ability to do those two sorts of things, with offensively second base being sort of like the biggest hole in the lineup, I guess, at this point, the last hole, realistically. I mean, which is also a position that's been staffed by an all-star and a guy like Biggio, who, you know, while I always have bad opinions about Kevin Biggio, he is he's a guy who's just barely under league average in his appearances this year. Been worth more than one win above placement. And it seems, you know, more than capable of doing that job. So again, lots of Swiss Army knives for John Schneider to play with, which is pretty cool. So good to see. We saw all the Jays acquisitions get some action this weekend. Zach Pop made a couple appearances. Anthony Bass pressed into duty a few different times. Nothing really out of the ordinary. I guess it's only been a few games. Zach Pop gave up a couple hits, but didn't give up any runs in his first outing. Pitched fine the next time out. Anthony Bass had a little bit of a rougher ride, but hasn't pitched poorly. That's for sure. But it's only been a couple games, a couple times out, and of course coming in those more challenging situations where he was coming in behind Tim Mayza,
who was of course injured. Particularly rough ride. He gave up a home run in that 9-2 game.
Yeah, and that's then, right. He did too. That's right. He did.
And then I think the rest of his outings have been scoreless. I think he gave up a walk, maybe gave up a hit, but I don't think he's allowed another run.
Yeah, that's right. He gave up the home run in the debut against Minnesota. Then he pitched two, gave up a walk, and then he pitched and then he gave up a hit there on Sunday. But he did pick up the hold, for whatever that's worth. And he's got three strikeouts in those 2 2/3 innings. So exactly what they thought they were getting in former current Blue Jay Anthony Bass. Now we should talk about Mayza. The decision to go and bolster the bullpen was a wise one. As you never know, everybody's every pitcher is one step off the mound away from being on the disabled list. It seems like so many pitchers just, they just seem to get hurt falling around on the mound. Tim Mesa, with a valiant effort to field a, was it a bunt or a swinging bunt from Sandy Leon? I don't even remember.
It was supposed to be a squeeze play type.
Oh, that's right. It was a safety squeeze in front of the plate and Mesa came charging in, lunged. I don't know if it was in the lunge or in the fall. You may know
the, it was the fall. So he lunged, tried to pick up the ball with his glove, but missed it. And then sort of just almost slipped and toppled over. And as that was happening, he collided with the base runner.
His arm got into the base runner. Yeah.
Yeah.
Without the ball.
It was So I think it was the collision with the base runner that dislocated the shoulder. I'm assuming potentially the collision plus the fall, maybe both. But it was pretty obviously dislocated right away. You could tell.
He was not okay. He was kicking and rolling around in the dirt, which is never a good sign. That is a suggestion of a person in distress. I will leave it to you. Is he done for the year? I don't know if I've seen anything that says anything one way or the other, but
there wasn't a definitive answer yet. I think there was optimism that he wouldn't be done for the year. The way that John Schneider had talked afterwards, he said something along the lines of, and he'll be back for us and down the stretch or something like that. So that was immediately after. And I don't think that they had had an MRI yet. So obviously the shoulder had been popped back in by that point, and Mesa was in a sling. I don't know what I think the recovery time for a dislocated shoulder probably greatly varies. And I think it also depends on like if you've ever dislocated your shoulder before. This was Mays's first time dislocating his shoulder. So popping it back in was a little bit trickier. I asked one of the trainers, like, who did it? And he said the Minnesota doctor did it because it was, again, it was like the first time. And I guess if you've popped your shoulder out a few times, putting it back in is easier. But the first time it comes out, it's actually a bit trickier. So they had the Minnesota doctor do it. But I guess I could see Mesa being done because it was a pretty significant injury. At the same time, it was his non-throwing shoulder, which I asked, like, is that is that matter? And John Schneider kind of smirked and was like, well, it's better than it had been his throwing shoulder, which like, duh. But I think that it's still bad. It's still a bad injury. I'd imagine it's going to be somewhere along the lines of like at least 6 weeks recovery, right? And an MRI would probably be needed just to see if there's any sort of other kind of damage or whether it was just like sort of a clean like dislocation. So I don't know that we, long way of saying, I don't know. I think we don't know if Mesa will be back. I think there's some optimism that he will be back. The way that the Blue Jays were talking about it afterwards was like, it could have been worse and we'll get him back at some point. And so that might've just been like post injury optimism from their part. But I think we don't really know a timeline yet. Potentially it's maybe he's available in the playoffs if they get there. And it's because then you're talking about almost 2 months away at that point. So maybe that's possible. We'll have to wait and see, I guess. But long way of saying, I don't think we can say he's done for the season at this point until we have more information.
Yeah, the non-throwing shoulder piece is big, but at the same time, it's not as though throwing a baseball at 95 miles an hour is something that's done with one arm and one arm only. It is a full body activity. I can't picture Mesa's mechanics in my head, but his arm is not stuck to his side. His non-throwing arm is not just kind of hanging there limply as he guns 95 in there. So that's
and
a
you
blow.
Still have to catch. You're still wearing a glove, and you've got to catch with your non-throwing shoulder or non-throwing arm. So it's not as though you can just go up there and put that arm behind your back and just throw.
Jim Abbott pitched a no-hitter in the big leagues, man, and he had one hand. He, of course, had spent his lifetime perfecting that. I don't know if you're probably too young to remember, but that amazing technique where he would hold his glove with his non-throwing arm that did not have a hand from birth, and he was able to transfer the glove onto his same throwing arm so quickly, unbelievable. Jim Abbott threw a no-hitter, pitched for the Yankees and the Angels back in the day. truly like a ridiculous, like a insanely great story of just like determination and like making, doing what you need to do to be, to live your dream. Good for, shout out Jim Abbott. Any opportunity to talk with Jim Abbott is a good one. More Spin Rate coming up right after these words from our sponsors.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
What does that mean for the Blue Jays bullpen now without Tim Mesa, who was obviously a high-leverage guy, obviously a guy having a great year? Matt Gage, I believe, is back up, and now Trent Thornton's on the taxi squad. But Gage has been pretty good, but he's not Mesa, I guess, is the concern.
Well, it's actually the opposite. The initial move was that Trent Thornton was activated and Matt Gage is on the taxi squad. I don't know exactly the reason for that, and we forgot to ask because of all the things that were also happening after Sunday's game. But Matt Gage is around, so I would presume potentially against the Orioles that he'll be activated. So they'll have a lefty in their bullpen for that. But outside of Gage, there's not a ton of options down the Blue Jays depth chart. The next name I think you would turn to or you would think of would be Taylor Saucedo, who was with the team in April very briefly, then got injured, and then has been on the IL ever since. It was a hip issue that he was dealing with then, and he's been on the IL for a long time, and then at some point he was transferred to the 60, probably for a roster move, and then he's ever since has just been on the 60, but he's been pitching in Buffalo. He's been pitching really well in Buffalo. So I wonder if he'll finally get a look. Matt Gage has the first chance, but if he doesn't get the job done, I would assume the Blue Jays turn to Saucedo, and maybe they bring him up either way if they feel like they need another lefty or they feel like they want that look in their bullpen or that he's earned. But that would take a 40-man move because, again, he was put on the 60, so we were removed from the 40-man. So that would be a little bit of roster juggling for them. But, yeah, not a ton of options. Losing Mesa was big, not just because he was a leverage arm, because he was pitching really well, and because he's kind of seen as a really important figure in the bullpen, just sort of from the intangible standpoint. But he was also the only lefty. They don't have another option there, and they like to use Trevor Richards sometimes against lefties with the changeup. But obviously Trevor Richards, while pitching a lot better lately, he is a bit of a three true outcome type of guy where it's either walk, strikeout, or home run, it seems, a lot of the time. So you feel okay about using him, but you also maybe don't love to use him when guys are on base. Whereas Mesa, you felt always comfortable using him with guys on base because he's so prone to those ground balls that you can get a lot of double plays with him on the mound.
I will say, and I'm glad you brought that up, Trevor Richards is a great example. This year against lefties, Trevor Richards has faced 84 of them. He's got 24 strikeouts, 8 walks. He's given up 3 home runs. So, you know, not terrible. And the Blue Jays, to their credit, they have a lot of guys that have a lot of different looks, right, in the bullpen. So even if it is only righties back there, especially in the higher leverage, I think they could probably get away with it. because, you know, you've got pitchers like Richards or a guy like Adam Simber, right? Coming from down below like that, you know, his numbers this year against lefties are pretty good. Same mm-hmm. thing. Again, not only he's allowed 8 runs, Adam Simber, against 69 lefty plate appearances. You know, Zach Pop, sinker slider guy that can maybe get in there and break some bats or keep stuff off the plate if he's throwing that sinker out to the outside corner against lefties, and then he can come back with the slider back onto their back foot. Yimi Garcia. So I said Yimi. I think Stoughton called it out that Atkins was calling him Yimi, and then the pronunciation guide has changed or something.
It's Jimmy.
But I think it's gone back is what I'm saying. That everyone was calling him Jimmy, but then Atkins was calling him Yimi, and then the pronunciation guide said it was Yimi. I had been calling him Jimmy too, but anyway, he's been great against both is what I'm trying to say. Garcia, he has pitched really well against both lefties and righties. Not striking out a ton of lefties, but not giving up a great deal of hits. 9 hits and 61 plate appearances for lefties against Garcia. So I don't think that they're up a creek. It would be nice if there was somebody who could step in and do that job, someone who is a lefty killer. But I think with the 3 batter rule, those days are gone a little bit.
Yeah, they are a little bit.
I mean, who you look ahead, who, if you're facing the Yankees, right? Maybe you want somebody who can get lefties out really well. If you've got Anthony Rizzo, is that Anthony Rizzo, Matt Carpenter? Is that really what you're loading up for? I mean, I should reserve judgment about Rizzo, but you know, the Yankees have so many good right-handed batters. As an example, Houston got a lot of good right-handed batters. Do you want a lefty? Does it matter who you're putting in there against Yordan Alvarez? I will hazard a guess and say that it does not. I don't care who you got going up against Yordan Alvarez. You're up Schitt's Creek. Meza is there's a reason that he was such a key piece to the bullpen. I think that it could be okay without him, I guess, is the long way of saying they can maybe spread those high leverage lefty plate appearances around. Maybe there's a keep a couple of those couple guys away from them. But it sucks. Truth be told, it sucks. There's no other way around it. But they will try to figure something out.
Yeah. And if there's the silver lining, maybe it's not that he's done for the year. Maybe they can have him back when it really matters late in September or early October. Before the postseason, that would be nice. And the one thing about Meza is that he's come back from a lot worse. So that was one of the things that John Schneider had said, that they know he can come back and he's almost been better post that gruesome Tommy John / other arm injury that he suffered back in 2019. So there's some optimism around Tim Meza. But yeah, it sucked to see. You never want to see that on the field, and it just looked like he was in a ton of pain. So
I'm sure that he was. Feel strongly that he was. Also, Zach Pop, pretty neutral splits when you talk about him against lefties.
I'm assuming that Anthony Bass is probably fairly neutral as well.
Yeah, I can double check, but I feel, as a Blue Jay, his numbers haven't been good. He's faced 4 lefties, and that was one of the home run he gave up was against the lefty. So in his one inning against lefties, doesn't jump off the page, but that doesn't mean that he's not a guy who has pretty good splits. Actually, his 2022, yeah, not bad, but in a significant split, way better against righties than against lefties. So maybe Anthony Bass is the one you want to keep away a little bit. Nevertheless, we'll move on to the offense, which scored 9 runs Thursday. Didn't score quite as many, but it's hard not to feel good about the state of the Blue Jays offense right now. I think the next piece we could talk about. Obviously, we've talked about the impact that a guy like Whit Merrifield makes, not just in the batter's box, but on the bases, as well as the flexibility he gives him in the lineup. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is it a 19-game hitting streak? Maybe 18. Not that many. 18. Hitting the ball over the fence every so often as well, even though he still, you know, does Vlad stuff and hits the ball on the ground a lot. Bo Bichette had a great weekend. The reports of his demise were greatly overstated. Matt Chapman is still kind of riding high, looking good and turning in good plate appearances. I guess maybe is there any concern about the slumping Alejandro Kirk, who I believe is he still mired in like an 0-for-20 slump?
No, he had a hit. He had a single the end of the Minnesota game on Sunday. So he there broke you go. That. Yeah.
He's back. He's back in a big way.
I think there's probably been some adjustments made to him, given that he was among the best hitters in the majors for a while there, and certainly one of the most dangerous hitters on the Blue Jays team. So you kind of expect at some point pitchers are going to adjust back to him and he's going to have to make the adjustment. I think towards the end of the Minnesota series, you saw he was making good contact. There was a couple instances where he just hit the ball right at somebody, which happens. So you like to see how hard the ball is coming off of his bat. There has been a little bit more swing and miss coming from him. Potentially that's just from some frustration, from some trying to, you know, break the skid a little bit, but he did get that hit. And so that's good to see. And he was hitting the ball pretty hard in some of those last plate appearances. So I would also take a positive from that. I also wouldn't be that worried. The guy hits. That's what he does. Like as he came up the system, as he's performed in the major leagues, he hits. And so you can expect that every player is going to go through a little bit of a skid. Maybe it looks a little bit more stark because for like about 2.5 months or whatever, however long it was, he was just such a automatic hit or very tough out. And so lately we've seen him look a little bit more vulnerable at the plate, but I think there's probably very low concern about Alejandro Kirk because he just figures out a way to get hits. And so I think that you like what you're seeing up and down the offense. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. has also been on a tear and he has, I believe, a 20 game on base streak going right now. Mm-hmm. He probably has the highest average on the team, I would think. He's almost turning into his brother a little bit in the sense that Yuli, I think, won the batting title last year. Yuli's not having that type of year this year, but Lourdes is. And Lourdes has obviously exchanged some power for a different approach at the plate. And he's walking a lot more. He's getting on base a lot more. He's just singling a lot more. And it's kind of been cool to see that evolution of his. And Vlad looks great. He basically looks almost nearly like the 2021 version of him. Like you get this feeling where you start to just expect that Vlad's going to get a hit. And I started to feel that in this last week's series, especially in Minnesota. It was like, you just kind of knew he's going to get a hit here. Or he's going to get on base here. Like you're not seeing him look a little lost at the plate. He's really zoning in on his pitches, I think, right now.
Couple things. Number one, Lourdes is leading the team. He's got a 312 average right now. Yeah, not hitting as many home runs, but like getting on base and just like being. I really like that. At the quote, the teens, I love that for you, Lourdes, because it's like a really good counterpoint to what the lineup was, even when it was, you know, world destroying. He's just sort of broken that mold a little bit of not being like a free swinging kind of, you know, all or nothing sort of right-handed batter with a lot of swing and miss in his game. He's changed that and it just makes the lineup that much tougher. And it, you know, when there are guys who get on base as much as so many of the Blue Jays are when they are right, it really is, makes him a really, really difficult out. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. So this perception versus reality. Sometimes Vlad has had obviously not been as good a hitter or not had as been as productive or had as much success in 2022 compared to 2021. What do you think his weighted runs created plus is? I don't know if you've looked at it recently.
So I think last year he ended with like a 141 or something like that. And I think this year he's at about 130.
Who, Vlad?
Yeah.
Yeah. So last year Vlad's was, he was 166. So that's 166, like, okay, really good, right? Like that's six. So it means he's 66% more productive than the league average hitter. This year it's 143.
Oh, this year it's 140.
It's the quietest 143 of all time.
So I think what I looked up was that I think in the first half he was 130. Mm. And I think that he's now raised it to about 143, as you said. And I think when I looked it up yesterday, it was 141 probably before the game. So even the first half where we were not necessarily we, but the general discourse around Vlad was how disappointing the first half had been for him. Meanwhile, he's 30% better than league average. And in the whatever amount, couple weeks of time we've had in the second half, he's already raised that more than 10%. So we could be talking about a second half. I mean, what are his second half? It's probably his second half rated runs created plays is probably in the 200s.
Yeah. In the last 30, where do I have it here? In the last 30 days, where'd it go? His numbers are crazy. Numbers are really, really good.
He's hitting 400, over 400 in this 18 game hit streak. Since July 15th, he's hitting 411, 30 for 73 with 8 doubles, 3 home runs, 16 runs scored, and 12 RBI. It's his longest hitting streak of his career.
Last 100 plate appearances, he is hitting 359 with a 576 slugging. So his weighted runs created plus over that period is 174, which is good enough for third on the Blue Jays. Obviously, Matt Chapman, who went off, striking out a ton, Matt Chapman, 40% strikeout rate, but it doesn't matter. Hit the ball over the fence and everything's good. And I want to take one quick second. We talk about the offense. We talk about where it is. This is that they're at that point where even though they only had really one big outburst over the weekend, but there's just so many dangerous hitters and you don't know who it's going to be. And when they're able to kind of score runs in different ways, as Whit Merrifield demonstrated with, advancing on one fly and then scoring on a sac fly that was not hit particularly deep by Kevin Biggio, that adds another element because they do just all hit. And the guy I, of course, want to shout out is Teoscar Hernandez, who is ridiculous. Yeah. He's so good.
Really Teoscar good Hernandez.
Let me ask you, I'll ask you this then. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put you on the spot once more. What do you think Teoscar Hernandez is OPS plus? We'll use OPS plus because I had it handy this year. Again, a guy who was mired in a long slump off the start of the season.
OPS plus, I don't use that set as much.
It's basically the same as weighted runs created plus. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's 100 is average, right? So I would say his OPS plus is 125.
It's 131.
Okay.
So you were very close. 131, 30% better than league average, which is the exact same number he posted in 2021. It's a little bit of a different shape. He's not getting on base quite as much, but he's just having another great year.
And I think he's hitting more singles and doubles this year. He's not hitting as many home runs. Mm-hmm. He is lately. He's started to find his swing, but I think the injury that he had earlier in the year, maybe, and those oblique things are always, players can come back from them sometimes fairly quickly, but they can also be one of those lingering types of injuries where whether they're affecting you, whether your mind is saying they're affecting you, all those types of things. So I would assume that influenced some of his power early on. But you're seeing him now look like the guy he used to be with the big swing. He's getting his doubles, but he's also getting a lot of home runs lately. He also, the number of Jays that have hitting streaks right now, I think he's also on a hitting streak, 8 games. And in that span, he's hitting over 300 with 3 doubles, 3 home runs, and 6 RBI. He also has 43 hits in his last 36 games.
If you go back over the last 3 years, in terms of weighted runs created plus, he's number 8. In terms of wins above replacement, he's number 10 among all outfielders in all of baseball, ahead of some really good players. Are behind him. He's just really productive and is a fun little base runner because he's very fast and has hit lots of home runs. He's got 60 home runs, which is just behind Mookie Betts, Bryce Harper, Juan Soto. Obviously, he doesn't get on base as much as Juan Soto because nobody does, but just a great, great player and a huge part of this team.
Also, let's just shout out because we haven't, but Kevin Gausman has not allowed a run in his last 2 starts. 14 innings, struck out 15 batters in those 2 starts. Much more against the Rays. He struck out 10 Rays, which he matches up well against the Rays because they swing a lot. They strike out a mm-hmm. lot. Whereas mm-hmm. the Twins do not strike out a lot. They're more like the Jays where they can put the ball, put the bat on the ball. But Kevin Gausman's, he had his season worst outie in, I think, three starts ago against the Cardinals, allowed 5 runs. It wasn't even that. It was bad, but it was like not horrific.
Well, there was that bad one, and then there was one against the Orioles in Toronto when he was like sick or whatever.
Yes, that was bad. But that was like he just didn't even get out of like the second or third inning or something like that. It was, the Cardinals were like I think he pitched deeper, but they put up 5 runs against him. Mm-hmm. But he's looked really good lately. And so I just wanted to shout him out because we talked a lot about every other aspect of the game and not Kevin. Sometimes, honestly, Kevin Gausman has been in so many situations where he has had games where like he's the only thing to talk about. But I feel like he's also been in a lot of games where like you forget, like he was the pitcher in the 28-5 win over the Red Sox. So in no way was he factoring into my story that night, even though he pitched really well enough. It was like, sorry, Kevin Gausman, I know you threw 5 innings here, whatever it was, but
those two games have something else in common other than being Kevin Gausman starts, which is perhaps the linkage here. That was a game in which the Blue Jays did not walk a single batter. In Sunday's game, the Blue Jays did not walk a single member of the Minnesota Twins. I get the sense that the Minnesota Twins are not easy to walk, but when you have a pitcher with as much control and command as Kevin Gausman, who is only walking 1.5 batters per 9 innings, you put yourself in a position to win, and then it makes it harder for offenses like the Twins to stack hits and hits and hits on hits when there aren't those extra free base runners that are mixed in there. The Blue Jays, 14 times this year, they have not issued a free pass, and you would not be surprised to learn that they are 12-2 in those games. They lost when they were shut out by the Rays, and they lost a game against the Yankees, which I believe was the game that Aaron Judge hit a walk-off home run. I'm going to bet that right before I look. And it was not a walk-off home run. It was something else. Not that game. But no walks. That's good to see. And that's, while the bullpen has been not exactly made over, but that to me is a sign of a bullpen that's going pretty good. And a pitching staff that's putting themselves, that's not shooting themselves in the foot by issuing those free passes, because that's where big innings are made. So a lot to talk about. Big weekend, lots going on, obviously injuries and grid performances all the way through the lineup, you know, your new look Toronto Blue Jays, who are taking on the somewhat old look Baltimore Orioles. Obviously the Jays host or go into Baltimore facing a team that is sort of on the outside looking in of the wild card race, a team that did not make much in the way of additions at the trade deadline, you know, famously traded Trey Mancini, kind of heart and soul of their team, who has gone on to hit many home runs in his short stint with Houston, who of course acquired him, as well as trading their closer
Jorge Lopez
to the Twins, who the Blue Jays just saw. So maybe the Orioles, you know, their best stretch of the season is behind them. That's not uncommon to say. What did they win, 14 games in a row or something obnoxious like that? That was Seattle, won 14 games in a row. But the Orioles are still a dangerous team, a team that can score plenty of runs, and a team that does still have a formidable bullpen, even without Jorge Lopez. Any keys or concerns, things you got your eye on when it comes to this Orioles series coming up?
Well, the Orioles are going pretty good right now. They've won 5 of their last 6 games, but granted, those games were against Texas and the Pirates, who were both not good teams.
They got blown up by the Pirates on Sunday.
Yeah, they lost that one, but they won the previous two in that series, and then they swept, I think, the Texas Rangers, who are not a good team. But the Orioles are definitely dangerous. I wonder that after the deadline, I think there was some speculation, is this going to be deflating for them? Because as you alluded to, they traded Trey Mancini, who was a longtime Oriole, was inspirational for that team both on and off the field. And then trading your closer, I think, was a bit devastating, because I think he had been a leader in that bullpen. He had been a guy that had found his form this year and was kind of leading that rejuvenated Orioles bullpen. And he gets to go to a team, he probably has a chance to pitch in the postseason now, whereas the Orioles, it's probably still more of a long shot that they're going to make the postseason, even though they are in the mix in terms of those teams that are just on the outside looking in. So this will be an exciting, probably still dramatic, tense series for the Blue Jays. It's interesting because I wondered if the Blue Jays were getting off a little easy. It's funny to say that against the Orioles, but were they getting off a little easy because so many of their games against the Orioles are backloaded into these final 2 months of the season? The Blue Jays have only played the Orioles 4 games so far, and they were all at home. They split that series against them, and those were pretty tight competitive games. I think there was one blowout on either side, mm-hmm. and then there was 2 close games. Blue Jays won one on a walk-off, the Vlad walk-off. Orioles match up pretty well against Blue Jays. They have an offense that's somewhat similar in the sense that they can put the bat on the ball. The bullpen, as you say, is really good. Where their weakness is obviously the starting rotation. And so the Blue Jays, this is the recipe for success for any team, but especially for the Blue Jays. They are so good when they are front running a team. And if they can jump out against, I think it's Jordan Lyles tonight. So if they can jump on the starter and put up, you know, 4, 5, 6 runs, they're really good when they are leading the way in games. So I think that'll be key for them because that bullpen, that Orioles bullpen is really good. It's tough to hit against. And by contrast, like the Orioles lineup is tricky to maneuver. So this series could be highly competitive. I think the Blue Jays still have the upper hand, but I'm excited to see how they match up against them. And actually, this is the first time that the Blue Jays are going to Camden Yards, where the dimensions are obviously different in left field, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, left.
Mm-hmm.
So
not as many
that's,
cheapy home runs.
Exactly. So they won a game last year because Springer hit a ball to left field that just squeaked over that fence, and they ended up winning that game. It was a comeback win. So this is the first time they're going there this year, so it'll be a different look for them. It's a different looking Baltimore Orioles team. It's a more competitive team and a team that's going to be really driven to beat the Blue Jays, because I think so far we've seen that the Orioles haven't gone away since the trade deadline. They could have just been like, well, our GM says we're not, you know, worthy of investing in, so let's just pack it in. But they haven't done that. But again, they also haven't played a really good team since then, I think, because it was Texas and then, yeah, the Pirates. So we'll see. I can see this series going so many different ways. I could see a Jays sweep. I could see an Orioles sweep. I could see a win on either side. I don't know. I think the Blue Jays have Kikuchi going tonight, which is always a bit of a
always adventure. Dicey. Always, oh, yeah. Dicey. Yeah, the Orioles are scary. Adley Rutschman has a 129 OPS plus. His OPS is up over 800. Of all the under 25 catchers in the American League East, he's definitely one of the best too. That much is sure. And then, yeah, like Ryan Mountcastle, who is a league average hitter who destroys the Blue Jays, kills them every single time. Cedric Mullins kind of back to earth a little bit. Anthony Santander having another good year at the plate. Obviously, Mancini's gone. Austin Hayes, famous for robbing a home run from Vladimir Guerrero Jr. In 2019. Famous to me anyway. Like you said, that bullpen is ridiculous. Dylan Tate, Felix Bautista, Brian Baker, and Cionel Perez, who has he given up any runs this year? His ERA plus is 351. He has an ERA of 115. That's pretty good. He's given up 6 runs in 44 games.
Brian Baker.
Is that good? Brian
former
Baker,
Blue
too,
Jay.
Yeah.
Former
Blue Jay. Jay, former drummer for Bad Religion. Wow, Brian Baker. Big day. Big series. It's fun. And hopefully the Blue Jays can dispirit the Orioles enough that the rest of their games, which is like somebody shared some absurd number, like 27% of the games remaining against the Orioles, like a 15 left out of what, 54?
Yeah. Well, they do. The Blue Jays do, keep in mind, they do have a pretty easy schedule for the remainder. They've still got series against the Pirates. They've got series against the Cubs left. They've got a ton of games against the Orioles. They still have a few games against the Red Sox. So early in the season, you wouldn't have said the Red Sox are an easy part of the schedule, but now they are. There's still games against the Yankees left, but, and there's quite a few games left against the Rays, but I mean, this stretch that they just like the Twins was going to be a tough one. So I think you walk away feeling good about a split, especially in that ballpark, because it's a tough ballpark to play in. Twins get really good crowds there. There was a lot of Blue Jays fans there, though. Like, there was a lot of dueling cheers happening. There'd be like a Blue Jays cheer, and then like the Twins fans would start booing them, and then there'd be so
that's fun.
It was a good crowd. It was a good crowd. But yeah, I think the Blue Jays are 3-3 on this road trip so far, and you've played two good teams or two teams that are also in playoff spots. So you're splitting so far. So I think if they could come away with a win in that Orioles series and then come out on the winning side of the road trip, they'd feel good about that.
Series coming up against the Angels, as you said, the Angels, the Cubs, and then they go to Pittsburgh. If you're a Blue Jays fan and you're jealous of watching your friends from Manitoba or Northern Ontario go and invade Target Field, or if you have people who have done the same thing in Seattle famously, and you live in, say, Southern Ontario or Western Ontario, maybe you aren't able to get out to as many Jays games in Toronto. Let me tell you, go to PNC. Are you going to Pittsburgh?
I believe I have asked to go. We'll see if I get
it. It is a wonderful experience. What a beautiful ballpark right down there in downtown Pittsburgh. Lots of places to stay nearby. Sometimes if you're lucky, you might catch the players walking from the stadium to the hotel. So if you're a Blue Jays fan looking to creep around, I famously saw Nori Aoki walking from the stadium to the when he was playing for the Giants, walking from the stadium back to the hotel, which was, again, famously to me. But go to Pittsburgh if you have the opportunity. It's a weekend series. They got an afternoon game on Sunday, evening game on Saturday. Good to look forward to. And if you are like me and you are right now doing some Ohtani math, trying to count and see if the Angels ace will get a start in Toronto. If he will, well, you will see me there.
I thought he left the game. Was he not hurt?
In his last start?
I thought he left the game, but I only saw a tweet that said Ohtani has gone down to the dugout, but I don't know if I ever saw a follow-up to that.
He pitched pretty well his last time out, I remember. I hope he's okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
He got hit with something. Anyway, okay. Maybe you're right. It says Ohtani, forearm. Nonetheless, he had three hits. Oh, that was Thursday. That was the game with the Angels at 7 home runs, and they still lost. Oh my
was
God.
Was it seven solo home runs?
They lost 8-7.
To the A's.
To the A's. Oh my God. It's terrible. What a terrible debacle. Oh, there is Shohei injury. What's going on? How did I miss this? This is important. Anyway. Oh, they collide awkwardly behind the plate, but both stay in the game. He's fine. Okay. Anyway, keep your eye out if you're getting a chance to see Ohtani start. It might be the last time you see him start in Toronto as a member of the Angels as opposed to a member of the Blue Jays. So something to look forward to. Caitlin will be there when the Blue Jays play the Angels in Toronto. She'll be covering the Jays series against Baltimore for The Athletic. So as I said before, make sure you go to theathletic.com/spinrate. Subscribe if you haven't already. They'll give you a tidy deal. We'll hook you up to read all of the offerings from within The Athletic. Make sure you subscribe to the show. We do twice a week. Me and Caitlin here today in your ears. Later this week, me and Ricky Romero will be doing a very similar thing. So subscribe to SpinRate. Hit us with a rating or with a review. We appreciate all the feedback. We love to hear from you. And we love to know that you're out there listening because it, you know, keeps the bosses happy as well. But that's it for this one. So enjoy this series against the now fearsome Baltimore Orioles, or at least wearisome Baltimore Orioles. But until we speak again, her name is Caitlin. My name is Drew. We will talk to you on the very next edition of Spinrate.